fluoric acid, everyone's nightmare, because if you spill it on you, it will actually seep through your skin, neutralize all your nerves so you can't feel it, so it's you don't feel anything until it reaches your bone, and then the nerves in your bone start to react and you feel intense pain. There's many legends, urban myths of people not taking sufficient precautions with hydrofluoric acid. Now, the acid itself is quite a weak acid, and this is the mystery that I'm going to look at in this episode of Peter Hill Explains. Hydrofluoric acid, what is it, and how is it such a nightmare acid, yet it's not such a strong acid? So hydrofluoric acid isn't the member of these hydrogen acids. So that's hydrochloric, hydrofluoric, HBr, HI, hydroiodine, acids. They're all different acids. And one of the things that you sort of think of immediately is that the halogen has one electron missing in its outer shell, so to speak. I'll have to get into this a bit more. And it robs the electron from the hydrogen, creating a hydrogen ion. And this in water dissociates into two separate things of hydrogen ion and a halogen anion. So it's a halogen minus F minus Cl minus. There's a little bit more to it there. How does that electron get from it? Why does it get robbed from the hydrogen? Why does it go onto, which I'm going to use a slightly more provocative word, into the chlorine or the fluorine? And the answer is basically that it's got a spherical or Gaussian uniform orbital around the hydrogen. The most probable position of the hydrogen electron is actually inside the proton of the nucleus of the hydrogen. In quantum mechanics, it's the size of the electron is a billion times larger, you can see this wave function of the hydrogen electron, or making the hydrogen electron and the hydrogen proton making up the hydrogen atom. And again, from quantum mechanics, you don't have the actual localization, but you do have momentum and applied speed, and the momentum is determined by the gradient of the wave function. And so if you've got a Gaussian wave function, which is a sort of like a bell curve going off to infinity, the gradient there is greatest at the waist of that function. It's at the greatest waist, that's the greatest speed. So the electron is falling into the proton from all directions at once, and reaching its maximum speed of falling in at around the Bohr radius. That's where there's a 50% probability, or 50% density, or fraction. So the electron actually has, I suppose, a density, a charge density, and it never goes to zero, even out to the edge of the universe, but it's, it goes to maximum density inside the Bohr radius, and you have 50% of the electron outside and 50% of the electron inside. That's an arbitrary mathematical boundary. So that's your hydrogen atom. But when you actually go to a fluorine, the electron itself, as the electrons pack in around the fluorine, so fluorine is one more than oxygen, there's It's got a 7 in the outer shell, and it's got 9 electrons all in all, 2 in the 1s, 2 in the 2s, and 5 in the 1p orbital. So the interesting thing is that it's the principal quantum number, which is that 1 or that 2 you put in front of the s and the p, is something which tells you it's constructed from the following formula, an arbitrary formula, which gives alignment with Bohr as a historical concept, and that is 1 plus the number of radial nodes plus the number of axial or cut nodes. So a 2p has 1 plus a radial axial node, so you have a 2p and a 2s together, so they're all things of the same row of the periodic table have the same principal quantum number, even though they may have different radial and different axial quantum numbers. It just means that they all add up to that. We've got the 1s, the 2s, and the 2p there, and those orbits, I suppose, hybridize or mix together, but that missing electron there from the 8 in the outer shell, or the 8 number of total of principal quantum number 2, it's missing, but there's actually a orientation of the fluorine. If you look close enough range, you can see the nucleus, the positive charged nucleus, and if you're an electron, that electron gets in close. It's a beautiful, beautiful specimen of a possum that I've never seen. Oh, there's one coming past. It's a nice... Oh, sorry, I'm talking while I'm walking England Brook in the Australian bush. And that's a beautiful young possum. Okay, continuing along. So that electron, if it gets close enough to a neutral fluorine, will actually be sucked inside and held captive inside the fluorine atom. And so it will spend different quantities of time either side of the fluorine nucleus. So if you can imagine, it can actually slot into a gap at close enough range. So at close enough range, the actual fluorine atom, even though it's neutral, is negative everywhere else and positive in the centre. So if you can imagine like a pom-pom on your hat, snow hat, you can pull aside and you can actually see into the core and slot more stuff in, but you have to actually push it through and thread it through. I'm trying to think of some common analogy where you have to actually push things in to lock it in. That's how the fluorine is. Now, the issue is that the fluorine, and similar, same story for all chlorines. Now, there's sort of two issues that we have to talk about. There's the ancient, the age-old raging debate, whether the hydrochloric acid is ionic or covalent, and the actual bond between it. This is the hydrogen sticks to the fluorine. Is that sticking a bond where the hydrogen atom is shared equally, or in each side? If it's shared equally in each side, it spends both an equal amount of time in both nucleuses, towards most nucleuses, and if it's actually of that form, for it to spend an equal amount of time with both nucleuses, it's got to spend an equal amount of time with both nucleuses, but also in between both nucleuses. So the electron itself finds a home sitting in between the two atoms. So it's sitting between the two atoms. It's a bit like a piece of blue tack between two marbles that actually sticks the two things together. And if you had to say which marble is most closely associated, it's hard to say. That's a covalent bond. An ionic bond is a bit more different, and people tend to focus on the fact that it's an electrostatic bond. You have basically a positively charged sphere and a negatively charged sphere, and positively charged sphere knows that there's an electron in that negatively charged sphere, and it tries to get closer to it, but it can't, and it's sort of stuck together. I was trying to think of an example of an electrostatic bond. If you have hundreds and thousands, and I think in America it's called millions and billions, that's of America, they're always up the standards, and you get it in, you hold your container and shake it, these little balls will become charged and stick to the surface of your container. If the container's see-through, you can see it. If it's not, you can lift the lid and see that these balls are stuck. And so this sticking process of two hard balls sticking to each other due to one having a plus charge and one's having a negative charge, that's an ionic bond. And the idea here is that the electron has gone on holiday from the one which has got a positive charge and is actually sitting, let's be quite frank about it, inside the other atom. So in chlorine, that's actually quite possible. For oxygen, it's quite possible. The actual electron can actually spend amount of times either side of the nucleus, actually be inside, deep inside the atom as it is. Now, of course, you'll have to forget the classical view of an electron as a tiny little orbiting speck. It's a large, sort of jelly-like. I think it's squeezable, it can deform. It's got all these beautiful properties. It can actually twist. It's got nodal lines where it goes in positive and negative phases. It can be shaped, and can be shaped such that it actually sits neatly inside, gets stuck inside an atom. There's sort of two aspects to an ionic bond. One is the fact that you've got an attraction, but you also have a repulsion. Yes, there is a repulsion. That is when the spheres cannot get too close to each other because the other electrons start repelling each other. So the other electrons really act like, in actual fact, a macroscopic ball. And in fact, if you want to think of a macroscopic ball which is packed with electrons and they repel more electrons coming into it, look no further than the ground you're standing on. Our planet is a massive ball of electrons. In fact, everything has bulk or density due to the actual density of the electrons and the fact that you can't actually push any more electrons through each other. Now, this is where it's, I suppose, hard to educate people. You do learn as a kid or as a human living on the human surface that a bunch of electrons will not go through another bunch. So if I have an apple, I slam it down on the table, it will bounce off the table. But that's actually not true on the atomic scale. So if you have something with, say, 10 electrons in it, like neon, each electron will actually push in through each other. It's just, so you'll have 10 overlapping electrons, pretty much spatially the same size, but they won't overlap. And I suppose the view is that an atom is something that you cannot cut, you cannot get smaller, because you've reached the size limit of smallness for an electron. So if you are to actually rip an electron off an atom, the atom can be a little bit smaller, probably not all that much smaller, but the electron you rip off is actually quite big. One of the strange things is you say, oh, it can't be that big, I can. But it is. If you keep it down at room temperature, it can get so large, or so physically large, it can't actually get through a wire grid, or things like that. One of the things is that you think of an electron microscope, oh, well, if I accelerate an electron right up, it can be so fine it can actually see submicron stuff. That's correct, but it can't actually get down to the size of an atom. You can't see atoms with the electron microscope. But furthermore, in an electron microscope, you'll have to get your mind around it. The electrons actually stretch out, so their actual position when they come out of the gun becomes less certain as they increase their energy. Their position increases, but their momentum or position in the y-axis, the time at which they pass an object, becomes less certain. So they actually increase in length. And this is sort of, again, hard to understand of an electron being a long thread-like thing, but you get a real strong feeling of it when you have something called a synchrotron electron source. And you have something the size of basically a small running track in a football field. An electron is accelerated around this track in a vacuum track, and it's like bent at particular points in time to actually change direction. Of course, when you bend an electron and you change its direction, it emits heaps of radiation. And so this is a great thing. You can actually get a radiation source of an electron itself, and can radiate due to the acceleration of a of charge. And now, this is one of the bizarre things. Obviously, an atom, the Simpson-style atom with the electrons buzzing around the place, would be accelerating all the time as they're going around in circles and producing heaps of radiation. The reason they don't do it is because they don't do it. They actually do not. They're not tiny little balls of charge, much smaller than the nucleus, racing around an atom, and the atom's mostly full of empty space. One of the people that shocked me most was Stephen Hawking. I think his book, one of the things is he makes heaps of claims about atomic physics, and indeed he's incorrect on this one. I want to get back to synchrotron radiation. You can actually have this device with a single electron, and the single electron can actually extend in length and wiggle, and that single electron can actually produce laser light. You can actually get that electron to go through something called a wiggler, and that wiggler can actually produce a very high brightness beam of light from a single electron. And of course, single electrons obviously do produce light when they go through transition levels, when they do accelerate inside an atom. That's when they do accelerate between an atom, they do actually produce light. The rest of the time, they're in sort of a suspended animation with the same electron half moving inwards from one side and half moving inwards from the other side, and sort of just continuously falling in into an atom. So one of the things with ionic bonds is that for an ionic bond to actually make sense, you have to have the electron from one atom ripped off and stuck inside another, and the other atom who's missing it overall, and it senses its charge overall, will try and get its buddy, but it's deep inside another atom, and it can't get closer because of atom-to-atom repulsion. And this is sort of very left off, and of course, leaving this concept off gives you this confused question of whether hydrofluoric acid is ionic or covalent. Does the electron spend most of its time on in the fluorine and none of the time orbiting the hydrogen, or is it covalent? Does it spend 50% of all of its time largely between the two nuclei, acting as a glue, that the two nuclei are positive charges, the electrons are negative charge, and so the atom is stuck together because it's actually tricked or shared its electron in the inside. Now, and I suppose one of the things that you have to say straight off is that a bond, because of the nature of electrons or covalent bonds, are always two electrons to make a bond if you draw a line, but an ionic bond can be just one electron going across. So obviously a hydrofluoric acid can't be a full covalent bond, it has to be a half bond because there's only one electron in it. So covalent bonds are always two electrons to make it up. People who are studying chemistry will think about this. But it obviously can't be ionic for a number of reasons. One is that you can observe that it hydrofluoric acid, and I hate to think of it, pure hydrofluoric acid has a low boiling point. So covalent compounds, because they're all stuck up about each other, are not necessarily interested in each other. So they're intermolecular bonds. This is the bonds between two molecules are weak, and so it has a low boiling point. So we do know that hydrofluoric acid, the hydrogen, is really buried inside the fluorine. Although this is a situation where the fluorine is extremely negative, electronegative, and fluorine does form really strong ionic compounds with other metals, it doesn't do it with hydrogen. So what's going on? Well, the fundamental thing is that people forget in going through all this that a hydrogen plus chemical is a chemical with no electrons. It's one of these. It's this exception I gave another YouTube talk about it. The H plus actually buries itself in the fluorine, so that's why it appears covalent, and the actual term ionic actually ionic bond. For an ionic bond, you need electron to be removed, but you also need other electrons which don't want to actually travel into the atom that it's hunting. So an atom is trying to retrieve its electron, tries to get in the front door, but it's locked. Hydrogen has got this beautiful tunneling ability and can actually get into the fluorine. So we have this issue that hydrofluoric acid is the most electronegative. Why is it a weak acid? And there's one of the things about acid, we'll go right through the acid theory in the next podcast, because it's one of these more fascinating talks. But why is it a weak acid? Well, in water, the hydrogen ion wants to stick with the fluorine. And why does the hydrogen ion not want to stick with the chlorine as much? Well, part of the answer is that the hydrogen ion is more thoroughly buried inside. But the other answer is that the chlorine is a larger negative ion, and being larger, as it goes larger, it can actually spread out its negative charge, so it's not as intense negative charge, so hydrogen ion, when it comes close, doesn't fall deeply into it. It's almost like a black hole or some gravitationally intense star. Things get captured around the outside of it. The chlorine is bigger, and so hydrochloric acid is a stronger acid because when in water, it is a less diffuse, more diffuse negative ion. So that ion gets at the first stage is the ion is bigger, and then the next stage after that. So it's the negative charge is fixed, and then the water polar molecules tend to stick around the side of that, diffusing or increasing the size of that negative charge till it actually grows to almost the whole size of the liquid. And if you really like to think of it, the Drude model, which is a crazy, crazy model from 1901, saying that electrons, this is for a metal, electrons are these free little particles which go through a sea of positive charges. That's actually a good model to describe a strong acid. The actual negative charges are diffuse and big, and the ions are quite happy to float around. That's the hydrogen ions, and float around being further away. And when you really come to think of it, this is why when you actually can build something with the negative charge really strongly put inside, but then you build up around a shell and a shell so it becomes a large negative charge, and then that negative charge gets shielded by water which sits on the outside of it, which makes it bigger and bigger and bigger. So the larger and more diffuse the electric charge, the less hung up the hydrogen is about sticking close by, and the stronger the acid. And I'm obviously thinking of SO4. So this is some absolutely large, big, hunking, big iron. It's a two negative ions. So this is a polyatomic molecule, sulfur with four oxygens on the outside of it. It's quite a thing to put actually process that through your head, but in terms of an ion, that's a very large ion, and miraculously it can actually hold two electrons inside it. So at close range, that even though it's neutral, SO4 is neutral, close range, when you look at it really close range, you can see angles and directions in which it is positive. You can actually see the positive charge inside, particularly because the electrons are being lifted off by the oxygens around the outside. So you see that sulfur charge, and the electrons will actually get buried deep inside that molecule. So much so that the two electrons can actually be buried in and actually not be repelled to each other. So if you've just got something with some ball holding two positive charges, two negative charges, those charges will tend to fly off, but those charges are really captured inside. So SO4 has the two electrons deep inside, and it's a large, so it's actually held, if you can imagine like a jewel box, the electrons are held deep inside, and the box is fairly large, and out on the outside of that box, sort of like a dust, because it's negatively charged, the water has a it's slightly polar. It has on the top of it some electrons, again from this quantum mechanical shape. They're not just spinning around madly. They've actually got a fairly robust physical shape. So the electrons of water, it's a boomerang shaped molecule. The electrons in water are at the top with the oxygen. And so these oxygens, the water tends to hang around this iron, pointing its oxygens towards the iron, and it's a little legs of the hydrogens away, and before you know it, you've actually built, from what was a tiny speck, an atom, you've actually built a large, diffuse, negative charge, and you've actually spread that negative charge over a very large area. Now, because it's spread over a large area, the hydrogen ion isn't necessarily strongly attracted or bound in there. It is sort of ionically bound, and so you have a lot of hydrogen ions available. So that's why these large polyatomic and these larger ions are strong acids, because they don't hold the hydrogen, and things which are electronegative can, when they do present a bolt hole for the electron at close range to go into it, they can actually go in and form a negative ion. The two separate concepts, and again, the concept of ionic and covalent really hinges on the method of attraction, but that method of repulsion, which is actually involved in ionic bonds, that is, the two ions can't continuously go and slam together, they meet this repulsion, that actually doesn't exist for a hydrogen or proton, that's a hydrogen ion, that's a ion without electrons, so it actually just buries itself if it can, if it's attractive, it gets close enough into it, it buries itself inside your hydrogen fluoride, so that sort of explains why it's a weak acid, because of its electronegativity, because of its size, the water doesn't get a chance to diffuse the size of the ion, and so this hydrofluoric ion, or even neutral, is if you just imagine it as a solvent, you can almost imagine hydrofluoric acid, which is a weak acid, it's actually getting towards the end of a slightly acidic solvent. As a solvent, it's a highly mobile solvent. I don't know, it's I think it may actually be a lot smaller than the size of a water molecule. So in terms of its ability to actually penetrate between water surfaces, or penetrate through fats and things like that, it's incredibly fat. And I think it was Nottingham University that had that person do the periodic table, and it shows fluorine, and I think it was hydrofluoric acid. He dips the chicken in hydrofluoric acid, and the analysis is more classical analysis than a full quantum mechanical analysis, but you can actually see the actual speed with which the hydrofluoric acid moves, because it bleaches the entire chicken lead really quickly. It just puts in, it doesn't eat it away, the hydrofluoric acid goes in and reacts quite quickly. So that's all I have to say about hydrofluoric acid. I hope my discussion of it has increased your understanding. A lot of people's understanding is limited by a very classical drawing an electron as a dot and stopping off from there. Taking a definition, an ill-considered definition, sort of just a very basic definition, but sort of not saying, oh, something else has to happen. And I suppose this is one of the dilemmas that when you're teaching this type of stuff, you can go this little bit further and explain a little bit more, and with a fraction of your audience, you do get great understanding, great inquisition. There's another fraction of the audience who become a bit scared, go to their textbooks. Of course, what you're saying, it's not in the textbooks, therefore they can say it's not in the exam. And so if they're achievement-oriented students, they can actually work them their way up, and then they go out to say, well, how historically has this sort of thing been explained? And in general, it's by people who are hand-waving and actually don't get into the deeper aspects that for ionic bonds, you actually require the ions to be hard balls, and for hydrogen, it's not a hard ball, it's a little speck of a proton that can bury itself in, and also to understand what are strong and weak bonds. Now, of course, what we also have to do is go through acid-base theory, and that's a real fascinating thing. I'll cover that with you in the next podcast. Thanks for listening. Bye from Australia. It was a scorcher day at 47 degrees up here in the mountains. It's now around 9 o'clock at night. It's gone down to the low 30s. Feels absolutely cool. Mind you, it feels absolutely cool now. Tomorrow will be another scorcher. And I'll see if I can get this next podcast for you as I do my cardiac rehab walks. Bye for now. Thanks for listening. In the meantime, keep on doing science.